Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College online journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Welcome to the War Room podcast, where we're broadcasting from the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. This is Jacqueline Witt. I'm Associate Professor of Strategy at the Army War College and the War Room podcast editor, and we're very pleased to have you join us today. Today we'll be exploring the issue of intelligence and its significance to the national security enterprise. Intelligence is sometimes overlooked by the public because its normal happenings occur behind walls of secrecy, except perhaps in times of crisis, which lends to a public perception that's sort of skewed about how things really work within the intelligence community. And then within professional military education, which we're of course concerned with here, intelligence can sometimes be sidelined because it seems peripheral to core issues when time is very tight in the curriculum. Yet understanding and exploring the complex and competitive global environment takes a robust and talented community of intelligence professionals who collect and analyze data and information to identify threats and to render best advice to senior leaders, including to the president. But we wonder what's actually involved in working within the intelligence arena. And particularly, we wonder what has happened and what has changed given what's unfolded since 9/11. To explore some of these essential questions, we have two guests today on the War Room podcast. Dr. Genevieve Lester is the DeSerio Chair of Strategic Intelligence at the U.S. Army War College, and she's going to sit down to talk with Mr. Michael Morell, Deputy Director of the Central Intelligence Agency under the Obama administration, and longtime veteran of the intelligence community. They discuss Mr. Morell's career, his experiences on 9/11, and dealing with its aftermath, the role of intelligence in policymaking and politics, and the relationship between intelligence and national security more broadly. So with that, we'll turn to Jen and to Michael.
Hi, I'm Genevieve Lester, the DeSerio Chair of Strategic Intelligence at the U.S. Army War College. One of my roles here is to increase awareness and understanding about strategic intelligence and its relationship to national security. To me, this is an area that deserves significant attention, and it also gives us an interesting perspective on the nexus of theory and practice. So I'm very happy to be here today in the studio with Mr. Michael Morell, whom, as you've heard, served as the Deputy Director of the Central Intelligence Agency from 2010 to 2013. In that post, he oversaw analytic and collection operations, represented the agency to the White House and Congress, and maintained the agency's relationships with other intelligence services and foreign leaders. He brings a wealth of career experience and insight about intelligence and national security to the table. Welcome to the War Room, Mr. Morell. Could I start by asking you to tell us a little bit more about yourself and your career?
Thank you for the invitation to be here at the Army War College. It's a real honor, and thanks for the opportunity to talk on the podcast. I worked for 33 years at the agency. There was not a single day in those 33 years, and if my wife were here, she would say he's not overstating this, not a single day where I didn't want to go to work. I spent a lot of time on the analytics side working on East Asia, various issues in East Asia. Spent some time in the Philippines in the 1980s when the communists were seriously threatening to take over that country. I was there for the Marcos Aquino election. Did some early work on North Korea. Was part of a larger group that discovered the North Korean nuclear weapons program. And then started a series of staff jobs. I ran the president's daily brief. I ran the group of people who put that book together every evening, right, to be delivered in the morning to the president of the United States. Then I was George Tenet's executive assistant for 2 years, and then I went on to other senior jobs, some of those on East Asia, some of those on terrorism. And then I spent a year briefing President George Bush, Bush 43, spent every morning with him from January 4th, 2001 to January 4th, 2002, and I was with him on 9/11 all day long. I've had a pretty special career, and, one that I look back on with great satisfaction and the great honor of serving my country.
Amazing. Can you just go back just a couple sentences to your experience on 9/11 with President Bush? This is obviously a huge moment in the history of the country, but also your experience. You were in the room with him, weren't you?
So I tell people, Jen, that it was a mixture of the intensity of doing my job with the surreal. And so what's an example of the intensity of doing my job? So on the flight from Barksdale Air Force Base, where we had landed to get rid of anybody on the plane who had nothing to do with national security and take on food and water because we didn't know how long we'd be flying around, on the flight from there to Offutt Air Force Base, where the president was going to do a secure video teleconference with his national security team, on that flight he said, "I want to see Michael." And so in his office on Air Force One, it was Andy Card, his chief of staff, the president, and me. And the president looked me in the eye and he said, "Michael, who did this?" And I said, "Mr. President, I haven't seen any intelligence that would take us to a perpetrator, so you're going to get my, you know, you're going to get my opinion here, you know, not hard fact." And he said, "I understand the caveat and I get on with it." And I said, "Mr. President, there are two countries with the capability to do this, Iran and Iraq, but neither one has anything to gain and both have everything to lose by doing something like this. So I don't think this was a nation state. I think when we get to the end of the trail, it's going to be bin Laden and Al-Qaeda." And I told him I would bet my children's future on that. So as an example of the intensity of doing my job, another example of that is later that evening on the flight from Offutt back to Andrews, the CIA had sent me some intelligence that was given to us by one of our foreign partners. And that intelligence made very clear that this was the first of what would be two attacks. So this was the first wave. So you can imagine the commander-in-chief, who just suffered the worst single attack in American history, right, on the homeland, to be told that this was the first wave and another one was coming, right? An example of the surreal, Jen, was on final approach to Andrews that night. The president's military aide was looking out the left side of the aircraft, left side of Air Force One, and waved me to come over. And he said, "Look," and there was a fighter jet on the wingtip of Air Force One. He said, "It's from the D.C. Air National Guard. There's another one on the other wingtip." They were so close, you could see the pilot, you could see the facial features of the pilot, and in the distance, you could see the still-burning Pentagon. So it's an example of the surreal.
It's an incredible experience. Later in your career, you became deputy director of CIA, correct?
Correct.
Was the perspective from that vista, that particular angle on events, both in the agency and then throughout the intelligence community and others who are dealing with threats like these?
So I had, you know, two, I guess I had a lot of jobs as deputy director. One was to oversee the business side, the mission side of CIA, right? The analysis we were doing every day and the operations and the covert actions we were doing every day. Somebody else worried about the business side, right? The IT and the security and HR and all that kind of stuff. I worried about analysis and operations. And so I oversaw that. And then I spent an awful lot of time at the White House in deputies meetings and in principled meetings and in NSC meetings, putting the intelligence on the table for decision makers, right? So every deputy's principals and NSC meeting begins with an intelligence briefing, right? Here's what the intelligence community thinks of this. Here's what CIA thinks of this, right? And it frames the discussion. And then as that policy discussion continues, your job as an intelligence officer is to make sure they don't stray from the facts. Right, they don't go off into la-la land, right, in terms of what's going on in that particular situation. So sometimes you have to drag them back, right, to reality, and say, no, that's not quite right. This is the way to think about that, right? And you also learn in those meetings. One of your responsibilities as deputy director or director in those meetings is to know what additional intelligence they need, because you hear the conversation about where they're, what they know, what they don't know, what they need, right? And even if they don't say it explicitly, you can interpret it. So you can go back to your building and you can say, okay, we need to do this, and this, right? To help them for the next meeting. So that's part of the job. Part of the job is representing the CIA on Capitol Hill, right? Because CIA is a secret organization in a democracy, right? How does that work? Well, there are two committees in Congress that are explicitly there to oversee what the intelligence community and CIA are doing every day to make sure that it is we're effective, we're using the taxpayers' money, you know, in the right way, and that what we're doing is lawful, right, and consistent with the Constitution and U.S. law. So a lot of time on the Hill, right, talking to senators and congressmen about what it is we were doing. And then an awful lot of time with our foreign partners, so the heads of other foreign intelligence services and then the leaders of those countries, right? Because the issues that we're dealing with today in the world are so complex that a single intelligence organization or a single intelligence community can't tackle them by themselves, right? You need partners. So we have partnerships with many, many, many intelligence services throughout the world. So part of my job was to maintain those relationships and to build them, both by hosting these people when they came to Washington and by visiting them overseas. So every 6 weeks or so, I would take a one-week trip. And in that 1 week, I'd go to 4 or 5 different countries and spend my time building those relationships.
Wow. It's a lot of work. Just along the lines of what you're talking about in terms of the intelligence side of things informing policy, I just want to explore a little bit the concept of politicization of intelligence
absolutely.
And that relationship, how it works between the policymakers and an intelligence and the intelligence officer, particularly the one in the room who's providing this support.
So it's absolutely critical that there be a bright red line between policy and intelligence. And so and the reason it's absolutely critical that that bright red line be there is because you don't want the intelligence in any way biased by politics, God forbid, or by policy itself. So the intelligence officer doesn't have a view about who should be president or not. The intelligence officer doesn't have a view about what the policy should be or not. And if there's ever a perception on the part of the recipient of the intelligence that that intelligence is somehow biased by politics or policy, then it's not going to be credible, right? And to be credible, it's got to be free of that perception. So the speak truth to power, be an umpire and call it like you see it, irregardless of what the president wants to hear, is the strongest tenet in the intelligence community and at CIA. And it is so strong a part of the culture that if anybody ever feels that intelligence is being politicized, boy, you hear loud voices and you hear many of them and you hear them loudly. We actually have at CIA an ombudsman for politicization, right? So if anybody at CIA, an analyst or an operator, thinks that anybody is messing with the independence of what it is they're doing, right? If anybody's trying to politicize, whether it's somebody in the building or somebody outside the building is trying to politicize what it is they're doing, they can go to that person, right, and cry foul. So it's taken extraordinarily seriously for very good reasons.
Some other friction points came up during that period of time. I think in the wake of 9/11, some would argue some extreme measures were taken. For example, enhanced interrogation techniques.
Right.
Do you mind speaking to that a little
bit? Sure. I mean, this is an incredibly complicated subject, and here's what I'd say about it. Here's how I always start the conversation about that. This is not, say, CIA's program. This is America's program. CIA did it, but the National Security Team approved it. The Department of Justice said, this is not torture. This does not meet the legal definition of torture. This is legal, right? This is consistent with U.S. law, torture laws, and this is consistent with the anti-torture treaties that the U.S. is obligated to uphold. The President of the United States approved it. The two committees in Congress were briefed on it, right? And actually some of the members there wanted us to go further. So this wasn't CIA's program. This was America's program. And now let's have a conversation about it, right? I think there are a handful of legitimate conversations to have about it, right? One is, was it necessary, right? Did you have to do this to get the information that you needed to protect American lives? Number two, was it effective in doing that, right? Some people say, well, look, you only get false information when you do things like this. So there's a debate about whether it's effective or not. And then was it legal, right? And the Department of Justice at the time said it was, but the Department of Justice since then has said, well, maybe they got that wrong, right? And maybe some of these things were indeed torture. So there is a debate to be had about the legality of it. And there was a handful of measures, right? So there's a discussion, legal discussion to be had on every single one of the measures, right? And it's different for every one of them. And then there's a moral question, right? Because something can be legal, something can be necessary, and something can be effective, and it can still not be moral, right? It can still not be the right thing to do. And on that issue, I would say, I don't think anybody knows what they would do if they were put in the situation that the President of the United States was put in at that moment. Because at that moment, he had the intelligence community saying to him, we fear there's going to be additional catastrophic attacks. We fear Al-Qaeda is trying to get its hands on a nuclear weapon. And we guarantee you that if they do get their hands on a nuclear weapon, they'll use it. We've captured these very senior Al-Qaeda individuals who aren't talking, who traditional interrogation methods are not working with. We recommend these additional steps. There's two sides to the morality of those harsh techniques. And they were harsh. I'm not going to play games here. Those were harsh techniques, right? There's two sides of the morality coin, right? One is, how can the United States of America, the country that stands for human rights in the world, the country that stands for freedom and democracy and all of those things, how can that country do those kind of harsh interrogation techniques? That's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is, how can you not do them if you think that they're necessary to save American lives? So that's the dilemma, the moral dilemma that the President of the United States found himself in, right? And given the situation at the moment, the United States had just been attacked. We thought more attacks were coming. More attacks were being planned, right? Some of them catastrophic. Given the situation at the time and given all of that, I don't think anybody, even the harshest critics of this program today, can tell you with certainty, I know what I would have done.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Very evocative answer. And just to end our discussion here on the Osama bin Laden raid.
Right.
Do you mind speaking to that a little bit? Describe what
sure.
happened. And also especially the political and interpersonal dynamic while that was happening.
Sure. So, you know, I had this I had this Forrest Gump kind of career, right, where I sort of was at the right place at the right time. So I was with President Bush on 9/11, and I was with President Obama on May 1st, right, when we brought bin Laden to justice. I was deputy director at the time. I played a huge role in overseeing the analysis and the operations that were related to collecting that intelligence. And then I worked very closely with Admiral McRaven in putting the operational plan together. So I was deeply involved in it. There was not certainty that he was there. You know, it was a circumstantial case. And I remember a conversation in the Situation Room where I actually told the president, because the president wanted to understand why were people all over the map in how confident they were that bin Laden was there. Some people, you know, 95% certain. You know, I was
60,
was
right?
60% certain, right? And the president wanted to know, why is everybody all over the map? And Director Panetta asked me to answer that question. And I told the president that I think people are washing this through their personal experience, right? That the analysts here are washing it through the post 9/11 experience of being a counterterrorism analyst, they've only known success after success after success. So plots and attacks stopped. Bad guys taken off the battlefield, right? Time after time after time. They've known nothing but success. They're washing this information through that prism. I'm washing it through the prism of Iraq WMD, which we got wrong. We got dead wrong, right? So I know better than anybody the uncertainty of intelligence. And then I said to the president, I said, you know, Mr. President, the case that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction was stronger than the case that bin Laden is at Abbottabad. And you could hear a pin drop in the room. Right? But that's an intelligence officer's job, is to put that kind of perspective on the table. So, you know, the day of the raid, you know, was a remarkable day. Because this was a covert action, the chain of command went from the president to Leon Panetta to Bill McRaven, did not go through Bob Gates, because it was a CIA covert action, not a military operation, because on the off chance that we went in and he wasn't there and we got out without being detected, we weren't going to tell anybody we did this. Right? It would be a secret forever until it leaked, right? And so it was a covert action. So we had an ops center at CIA set up, and we were talking to Bill, you know, who was on the ground in Jalalabad. You know, he was commanding the operation, so we were there until it was over, and then we went to the White House. I remember walking out of the White House that night with Director Panetta, and there was a group of drunk college kids in Lafayette Park from GW and Georgetown, and they were chanting USA, 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 CIA, 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 and, you know, I've never heard that before, and I'll never hear it again, right? But maybe the most special moment, Jen, of my career was 2 weeks later, because President Obama, knowing that I was with President Bush on 9/11, asked me to go to Dallas to brief President Bush on the whole bin Laden operation. So I took with me the lead analyst, and I took with me the JSOC J3. And we spent 2.5 hours with the president. And he was like a kid in a candy store, right? He wanted to know every single detail. And this was the thread of this operation, the thread of finding bin Laden at Abbottabad, dated back to 2002. So big chunks of the story happened during his presidency. So he wanted to know, right, exactly when these things happened. And at the end of the 2.5 hours, you know, he said, Laura and I were going to go to the movies tonight, but this is better than any movie, right? So we're staying home. And then he walked over to his desk, and he had given me some of his challenge coins before, but he had never given me his commander-in-chief challenge coin. So he took his commander-in-chief challenge coin and slapped it in my hand. And I looked him in the eye, and I could see closure, right? I could see closure, because this all started with him, right, on 9/11.
Wow. Thank you so much.
You're
for
welcome.
Talking about your experiences.
You're welcome.
And I know that's just a brief skim, and we look forward to hearing more.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's good to be with you.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.